Healing can happen when people share their stories. Welcome to Trauma, Trial, and Transformation. Discover true stories from those who were called to sit in the witness chair. Experience their journey through the legal process and beyond. This podcast brings to light the trauma and stress caused by testifying under oath and offers resources by talking with witnesses, key litigators, and mental wellness professionals to assist with different approaches one can utilize to prepare to take the stand and how to heal after the encounter. And now, here's your host, Juliette Huck.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome to Trauma Trial Transformation on a beautiful, wow, really beautiful sunny spring day. Came out to my studio and birds were chirping and bees were buzzing and butterflies were all around. It takes me back to just growing up on the farm. I loved spring. It's just getting out of that cold winter. And the other thing I'm very excited about today is our 50th episode. So give me a little tiny baby clap out there. I'm just so grateful to all of our guests and my producers, and I never thought we'd get this far, but I continue to have amazing people coming forward in my life, and I love stories, and boy, my guest today, let me tell you. So, you know, I'd like to begin with a question. Did you know there are U.S. military psychic spies? Do you know that these people exist in our lives every day? They might be sitting right next to one on a plane. You never know it. My guest today is a transformational psychic medium. She's a best-selling author. Her memoir, American Psychic, A Spiritual Journey from the Heartland to Hollywood, Heaven and Beyond. I've met her, sat next to her at a book signing, and what a delight. She's a national and international speaker. She offers spiritual and conscious training, but what I'm very interested in is her work in law enforcement. And she has been a pro bono investigative consultant for various, you know, law enforcement cases. She's with Natural Profiling Skills, extended crime, victim, and perpetrator to assist law enforcement. She receives information from the past to work with law enforcement and families in our present day. I know I'm missing on a lot of her accolades, and I'll let her talk about those things, but she's also been trained in methods used by the U.S. military remote viewers, as well as a technical mount dowser, which, oh, I can't wait to talk about this because I love about talking about dowsing especially. So I want to welcome Marla Fries. Marla, welcome, and thank you so much for being here. I paths have crossed many times, and I'm just so thrilled that you're here.
Thank you so much, Juliette. I'm delighted to be here.
Oh, that's so great. So I want to just at the very beginning here, before we really get into the law world, can you explain to my listeners the difference between a medium and a psychic?
Well, a psychic is using all of the gifts that we all have. We do have these. You know, you've heard about the clairs, the clairsensing, clairaudient, all of that. It really is being able to see, hear, and feel information. And so as a psychic, I'm able to access information. If you want to look at this as a virtual reality, that would make it an information system. So I'm able to access past, present, and future information about any aspect of someone's life. It could be your relationships, your business, your career, the house that you live in, the dog, the cat. It could be anything about your life. And the mediumship part is connecting to deceased loved ones.
Interesting. So the medium, those are two very different things, correct?
Well, some people I would imagine came to the mediumship or even the psychic stuff when they were children. That wasn't necessarily the path that I took, but I love the details of what happened with mediumship with me, because I was a snarky little skeptic. So that came in the mid-90s. And there were things that were peppered through my childhood that gave me psychic awarenesses that actually changed my life. So,
yeah, you know, and I think a lot of people too, I want your opinion on this. Like, I was with a client yesterday, and we were talking about this interview today. And at first he's like, you know, I'm a little bit of a skeptic of that. And I said, have you ever just sat in a room and had a really interesting feeling come over you, like around you. We don't stop to think what that might be. It's just like, oh, they, you know, we, I don't know. I mean, would you see it as we just don't stop to be aware of it? It's all, to me, it's always around me. It's always speaking to me. And they're like, does that make you feel better? And it's like, no, it's just communicating. I mean, do you see that in a way where people just don't stop to know that it's there?
Well, I don't think that they know how to think or feel about these things. I like to tell my clients and my students, get in the shower and just start listening and paying attention while the water is pouring all over you, that you're getting downloads. You might be getting information about what you have to do during the day, and then all of a sudden something pops into your head that says, hey, call Sam, call Andy, call Alan. It could be just the thought that you were paying attention to the thought. I don't think that people understand that we only can change things that we're aware of. So if we become aware of what's coming into our consciousness, then we can start spending time accessing more information.
Right. And it's, you know, mindfulness is such a great word I use a lot, especially with even working with clients. It's like, you know, this client asked me yesterday, I go, it's funny, I walk in this conference room and I know exactly which chair to sit in the minute I walk in the door. And she's like, how do you know that? And I said, it's my mindfulness. That's the energy that is going to be there today. Now, do I make a big deal of it? No. Do I have to live by this? But when something's talking to me, it says, sit here. It's what I do. So it's like listening to that in that way. Is that what you feel like? So, but I guess let me back up a second. You know, before you got into all this, how did you realize you had the gift? Like, where, let's talk a little, just a little bit about your story on when did you realize and accept it, even though you were a skeptic?
Well, I think that we need to go back to childhood where my sensitivities were heightened because I was in a traumatic, abusive situation. And between my mother's craziness and her physical abuse, my father was an alcoholic, and we had to navigate all of that that was going on in the house. So I began to know things early on. And I think this is a really good piece of information for reincarnation, because how in the world at 3 years old would you know that your parents were behaving poorly? Or be mad at the consciousness, the universe, the God consciousness that would send you down here. And we're in trouble going, I'm so angry. Why did you put me here? But of course, there were elements about seeing things. Like, I don't know if you remember in the book, there was one of my classmates. We were all pulled into this high school, 7th through 12th grade. And I was sitting across from this girl the first day of school, and I didn't know who she was, but she was really sweet and light and sort of like slender. And she had this dirty pocketbook hanging on the back of her chair. And I heard now the way that I hear things, pay attention, pay attention. There was something about me that wanted to protect her. I mean, she might've been pounds lighter than me, but she was somebody that I really wanted to pay attention to. And 2 days later, we were all at the football game, and her name was being echoed throughout the whole football over the loudspeaker. They couldn't find her. Well, she had been raped and murdered on her way to the football game. And that set in motion, Juliet, an awareness of me just changing my life. A murder in my own hometown. There were actually three in a course of 2 years, but that made me have to pay attention to what murder was like, what death, and all of the things that these children or even adults go through in the process. So that was my first inclination that I knew something was going to happen, which I find, you know, at the age of, 12 years old. Very interesting.
Yeah, I can relate to that, because I had a brother that was killed as a kid. And I you know, at the age of 8, I had a lot of things speaking to me, not knowing things were speaking to me. And I've never really called it psychic, or I felt like maybe more of a messenger in a way that, you know, things come to me and then I'm supposed to tell somebody else, you know, kind of thing. And which is probably the same thing, but, at a young age, I think you do get, when you're aware of it and your intuition and your awareness and your awakeness. And that's why whenever I'm working with people or clients, I'm like, just sit in the silence, you know, sit in the silence and see if you can find something that's coming forward for you in that way. So that's a pretty powerful way to step into, but your awareness is, you know, it's been coming. So let's talk a little bit. I kind of want to move a little bit into, obviously this is about the trial side and legal side of life. And I know in your book, you also talked about the Charnock murder, how you saw it, calling the DA. I really am interested for you to tell me that full story. I read a little bit about it in your book, but I'm anxious on that full story.
Sure. So this was the mid-90s, and I ended up working for a very famous medium. And that's a whole nother story because I really didn't believe in it. But he put me in a class and basically proved to me that I had these capabilities. But I was doing some volunteer work for him. And one of his personal assistant handed me an envelope. And I didn't know what it was. She just handed it to me. And all of a sudden, this is the strangest thing, Juliet. I went blank to my present circumstances, and I saw this old-timey movie. You know how it would flicker, and it would mm-hmm. it was a gun saloon sort of coloring to it. And I saw this man in a silver car, and he was driving up to talk to a guy who was in a white van. And the guy in a white van had slumped down on the outside, and I knew that he had killed himself by drinking himself to death. And I heard Stanley, and then I heard, look at the bar. And I was outside of a bar with CC. It ended up being Coach's Corner. And I went into that bar, and there was a man sitting at the bar with a baseball cap. And he knew this guy, Stanley, that walked in. And somehow he took him outside, hit him on the head with a hammer, wrapped him up in some plastic and duct tape. And I was like, oh my God. What the hell was that? And what I was holding was Suzanne Charnock's letter that she had sent to this very famous medium that I ended up working for. And I saw this whole thing. And I looked and called her, and we got on the phone, and she said, well, I'm just so glad you could call me. And she gave me the DA's number, and I called him up, and he had a really deep voice. And, Locke was his last name, but the dynamic was I asked him, so this is what I'm seeing. And this guy named Stanley, there's a woman that comes in and basically turns state's evidence against him. And he said, well, I don't know how you know this little lady, but these are the details of a murder that happened and I'm still working on it. So that was I know it was just crazy. And I didn't bother talking to him anymore. I continued to talk to Suzanne because this was really for the sake of the family. Mm-hmm. And I was just coming off the set of a commercial one day, and I saw at the base of my bag a Budweiser cap. I had just done a Budweiser commercial. This was when I was working as an actress. And I decided to call Miss Charnock and say, you know, I was thinking about your brother sitting at that bar. And she said, well, Budweiser was his favorite beer. And that white hat that you wore, that you saw him wearing that day when you had that vision, had Budweiser on the top of the, you know, on the cap. Wow. So, I mean, just crazy stuff like that. So that opened whole new door for me to not think that I was crazy, to basically start searching for help. And it was the U.S. military psychic spies who had disbanded in the early 90s. And I went to train with them.
Wow. So before we get into that subject, which I think that's going to be a much longer conversation, but how do you handle when someone comes through that has been tragically murdered with a family, like really trauma induced, like how do you handle that with people that are on this side of the veil versus on the other side of the veil that are trying to talk to you? Because I think a lot of time people are looking for answers, obviously, and trying to find comfort. But when it's really traumatic, how do you handle that?
Well, it's a good question, because when it comes to murders, I learned to do this because it's a hard way to learn this, but the bottom line is I will not work on a murder case unless they either do have the body or they have the perpetrator. Because stepping in and working on a murder case, I have to be invited by a detective. So if they know the perpetrator and they have the body, it's a lot easier for me to work with the family in their grief to get messages. And of course, that information, the person that is dead can be joking. And I'm like, oh gosh, you can't joke right now. You've got grandma and your sister and your mother and your best friend sitting here crying on the sofa. We have to be really gentle with this. So we work together. It's a very interesting dynamic because they're no longer in pain, the dead person. They leave their body and their consciousness remembers what happens. But as you will ask me about one of these cases that I was working with when he was murdered, he basically just came in and said what happened, which was the detail for his niece so that she knew what he was talking about, because I certainly didn't know anything about him.
So how do you take care of yourself in this scenario? Like, you've got all this energy kind of coming out and going through you to, and then it comes in from a legal perspective that then you've got, you don't only have the personal emotional side, then you've got a legal side. Like, kind of sitting in this very precarious situation, like, how do you handle yourself with that?
Well, very delicately. I don't have the pain associated with what happened to someone, but sometimes the information has a choke. And I was like, oh, I can feel this. I did a pilot where I had to work with law enforcement, and they took me to the actual area of where the perpetration happened. And of course, this was 30 years ago on this case, because it was a cold case, and I didn't have anything. And I walked to the area, and I knew that she was murdered and she was in the car, but I literally walked to the area underneath the tree and felt the choking. My voice went hoarse, and I could feel
right now. Like right now.
To think about it, the information, I'm tapping into the information. I'm just going into the information. In that information, being psychic, and everybody out there is psychic. Psychic information is basically, it's basically functioning of all of your elements, all of the sight, all the feelings, all the awarenesses. So you can let go of the idea of, using the word psychic. You can use intuitive, but that's just a psychic trying to look good. So so the dynamic of all of this is I provide information that is helpful for details. We call it evidence, evidentiary mediums or whatever. Right. But I don't need to feel it all in order to convince you of anything. I just get little snippets, whether it's however the person died. Oftentimes I'll feel a hit on my head just briefly. It's not important for me to go through the death. It's important for the deceased loved one to give the information for law enforcement or for their family.
Okay, so you use some really great legal terms in here that I'm not even sure you're using, but I'm going to want to go back up on this a little bit. Evidentiary information. Evidence is something that gets put into the courtroom, right? Why do we never see this kind of evidence that comes into the courtroom? Do you know?
I'm sorry, I just have to laugh for a second. Are you kidding me? Well, first off, those of us who work on cases like
I know this. I know the answer. I just want to see what your answer, because someone's going to ask that question.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it's pro bono work, right? So I'm talking to a detective. I'm talking to law enforcement. I'm giving them my information, and they get to wrap themselves around it. They get to wrap their egos around it and take it in and see what they can do with it.
Right.
It's for them.
Right. But it's for them. But it could possibly be evidence, right? I mean, that's what's so interesting to me. I mean, being in the courtroom, being in the courtroom and knowing, like, I've seen the strongest pieces of evidence, like, let's say a piece of paper that's the smoking gun, right?
Yeah.
Get thrown out. I mean, I've totally seen it like this. I'm sitting there sometimes like, that's the whole case. Like, how could they, it exists. How can they throw it out? They got a legal loop. It's, yet is it because people won't, have a hard time believing this? Is it because they can't put a finger on it and say this is something that's, a physical thing that can be brought into the courtroom? I mean, I'm just finding it so interesting that that there is this gap between, you know, hard evidence and psychic evidence. You know what I mean? Like there is definitely something to be said on those two terms, which I'm not sure has ever really been brought into the courtroom in front of a jury.
Well, let's look at it this way. The professionals that are doing their job so that you can get into the courtroom need as much physical evidence basically testimony from someone, but they get downloads too.
Right.
You know, when I worked with people from Quantico, you were talking about walking into a room and feeling things. These agents are taught ambiance. They're taught to sit in a chair and have people walk behind them and feel the mood of who those people are.
Right.
You know, when I walk into, I don't necessarily even have to go into a house, but I did do that working with law enforcement here in Los Angeles. And I can't talk about any of the people that I worked with, but I worked with everybody.
Right.
So it wasn't just detectives and cops. It was behavioral science people and all of that. Everybody's trying to look at their own awarenesses.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody wants to be psychic, and they are. So when a piece of information that comes to me goes to the ears of a detective, it's basically, I'm giving them what I'm seeing. Mm-hmm. Case in point, a particular, I have to be careful with this, hold on.
Right.
I walked into a detective's office at a law enforcement station and basically held onto that big envelope of information that comes in with a murder. And I put my hand on the top of it and I gave a name. I'm just going to make up a name, Mousy. And they looked at each other and went, oh my God, that was who they had in custody.
Wow.
For this murder. And I said, or at least they were thinking about it. And I saw what happened, how there was an informant and the perpetrator did some things to her. And they actually had a sexual encounter. The informant had a sexual encounter and she had some evidence on her shirt. Mm-hmm. I didn't know whether they had that evidence or not. I was just telling them what I saw. So they have I'm giving them a visual of something that happened in the best way that I could. They already knew things. So they put those pieces of evidence together.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the name, which, you know, whatever the name was, they identified with that person. And I told them, well, that person is in the system. And we had just found out that they had been taken out of one lockup and been moved to someplace else. And they got that person to question them. So it was right in the middle of that. So it was just pieces of information like that that happened and they took care of it. And I'm just, you know, oh, Marla, we'll call her when we need her.
Yeah. But maybe that's like confirmation almost in a sense too. You're adding to what they are starting and confirmation. I think sometimes people might look at it in a sense of like, okay, so that's confirmation. We were on that path, but now we know we're really on that path and you're giving more information to them than they probably had. So let's talk a little bit about, OJ. I know you did a little bit of work and that leads into something else, but you had a little bit of involvement in the OJ litigation for those who might be very young. I'm sure you've heard of the OJ case, but let's talk a little tiny bit about that. How did you get involved in that?
Well, let's just say, I don't think I had anything to do with the litigation.
Okay.
But, I was tasked to do a map and I didn't know what I was looking at. So when I was being trained by Lynn Buchanan, who was one of the basically top remote viewers that worked for the military, he basically trained me in map dowsing, which is a very interesting sort of dynamic of having a sheet of paper. And we don't know anything about where the paper on a map is. I know nothing about any of it, and it's double blind or whatever. But the point was, he would hold the paper and I would hold a ruler and pull it over the paper. And my hands would twist when the and he would make a mark. So he consistently turned the paper, and every time I pulled it over, my hands would stop and do this really twisty, weird thing, and then he would make a line. After a while, there were a few apexes on that sheet of paper, and I have no idea where their map is, whatever, but they took that and they put it on the map that they were looking for. And I found out later, you know, you don't find these things out right away. The point was the tasking or the target was the person who was responsible for Nicole Brown and Ron Goldman's death. Mm-hmm. And this was a piece of paper that, I don't know, was like 11 by 14. So I've been turning, it was turning and turning and turning. It's really fascinating to watch this. But I was like a fraction of a tiny little piece. I can't even remember what the 16th of it was, I guess, of an inch, or 18th or 20th, on Rockingham.
Hmm. Wow. So that's where it came out to, the apex started. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I'm a big believer in dowsing, and I know that a lot of people out there don't know what dowsing is. And the way I explain it to them is, back in even Native American times, you had a stick and they'd walk through and it would start to bounce when they look for water. That's the basic way of doing it. But dowsing works in so many different arenas and areas of how, like you said, your hands curl and the energy changes. And I just find it so fascinating that so that's the mapping. Is that correct?
Yeah.
That's how they do mapping. Now, what would you explain as what's the definition of a remote viewer?
Okay, well, there is some history to this. So a controlled remote viewing was developed with Stanford Research Institute and the CIA. They were working on developing this with a psychic by the name of Ingo Swann. So this was a faction of the military between the 60s and the 90s. And it had different names, but the point was the project brought in men and women who had gotten themselves out of very difficult situations. I guess there was enough information about all these people that they pulled them together, and they learned a very specific protocol. You were given a number, you had a specific way of writing your name down, the date, etc. And there was, as soon as you put your pen to the paper, your hand would do an ideogram. And it was that ideogram, that squiggle, that they would teach you how to identify. And it really was allowing your subconscious to bring forward information. I mean, there are a lot of people out there that we would call natural remote viewers. And this is kind of how I started, when I was being given that envelope. And I did the same thing with the Kristen Smart case, a heartbreaking dynamic that finally had resolved 26 years later. But that was one of the first cases I ever worked on. And I saw the dynamic from above before we even knew what drones were. I saw these kids walking in some area, and two went off to a building. And I saw various things about it. But then it was over. So I was one of the first people that worked on it. But what I saw was important as far as the pieces of the murder. And of course, we didn't find the body, and never did. But Paul Flores was still put away. But this dynamic of controlled remote viewing is very technical. Mm-hmm. And there are still people that were working for the military that are teaching laypersons like myself how to do this. And I think the best documentary is called Third Eye Spies, that is out on Prime Video, giving you sort of an overview. But there are some, Paul Smith is still teaching, Joe McMonagle, who had the number one top remote viewer. He is really one of the most incredible psychics in the world. And Lynn Buchanan, who I trained with, and people underneath Lynn. So there are if there's anybody that's interested in this, you can find somebody to train with. And I think that you might really enjoy it, Juliet.
Yeah, just I was going to say,
I will hook you up.
I'm sitting here thinking to myself, maybe this is fascinating, because I've had, I can tell you just a quick snippet. I think I've talked about on this podcast before, is I was involved in the Scott Peterson trial. And I had many, many moments on that case that I just have never really talked about, but I feel you're opening me up a little bit more to talk about from a psychic perspective, but in a way that things being talked to and others talking to me about things coming from other places. But the one that was the most powerful was we got to the house and I did not want to go in that house. I just did not want to go in. And I kept saying, please, I really don't want to go in this house. And then I said, Lacey, if there's any way you can stop me from going into your home, I'm begging you, right? I don't want to go into your home. And so the woman who had the key, she came to the door and she said, God, this key's not working. And I was like, oh, thank God. And she goes, oh, but I have another key somewhere in my house. Let me go across the street. She walks across the street and I'm like begging. I'm just like, please, please, Lacey, just don't make me go into this house. I really, there's something about it. I don't want to go in here. The lady comes back over. She puts the key in the door and the key would not work. And I never went in the house. And I mean, I know it's not funny, but at the same time, it was to me, because I was just the whole day, I did not want to go in that house. And I was putting out there so hard, please don't make me do this. And I don't know why it was. I still don't know exactly why, but I just was so strongly feeling I did not want to go and invade her space and in her home and be, you know, tromping around in a place that was so sacred to her. And yes, you've triggered my fascination, Marla, on maybe getting some training.
Yeah, so I actually think that you didn't want to go into the house because you did not want to see, hear, or feel what happened. It wasn't about not being in a sacred space. It was about you not wanting to be psychic and walking in there and being able to see, hear, and feel what happened in there.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what's going on.
Well, that's another whole conversation we'll have over Martinez at one point, but I have many theories around that case, and I know a lot of people are trying to get my theories out of me, but I don't say a lot about it. But anyway, we're moving forward. So let's talk about some transformation, and it applies to your new book that's coming out, which do you have a new title to your new book?
No, it's
no,
not.
You're still just,
no, it's okay. Just in the process.
Yes. And the process. Okay. Well, that's even more exciting, because I'm with you on that. I'm working on a memoir myself. So and you talked about this experience, and I'm just going to read this little tiny excerpt you sent me because I felt it was pretty powerful. It says, you know, this experience with an extraordinary family took the deceased's agenda off of offering support and encouragement to a broader level, ultimately impacting federal law. On March 30th, 2003, Susan V came to me with an intention of talking to her cousin David. On April 29th, 2002, Los Angeles Sheriff Deputy David March was making a routine traffic stop when Jorge Armando Garcia immediately stepped out of the vehicle and began walking toward David's car, pulling out a concealed weapon from his waistband and firing. And obviously he did not make it. And you're now meeting with the family. And how, tell me this story, because I find this is more of a transformation story than it is more of a legal story, which I'm always interested in the healing side of this.
Well, I love that you said that, because the whole point of the legal side is getting justice. And, you know, as I mentioned with the Kristen Smart case, that took 26 years.
I know.
Right. And even, you know, and I can even talk about other cases like that where it's not on our terms. It's on a whole nother level. So what happened with David March was his cousin came to see me, and I had worked with her before. Someone else that had gone down in a plane in her family, and we had great communication with that family dynamic. But when she came in, I didn't know anything about David March, and the dynamic was, oh, let me tell you how that happened. So, yeah, I was parked and I got out of the car and I saw that he had a gun, and I turned and pop, and pop. Well, the first one didn't bother me, but the second one, whoa! And then third shot, lights out. And so this was one of those situations where I said, listen, David, you got to back off here. I'm going to tell this story, but I had to prepare Susan for how he was speaking about this.
To you, because, from the other side, to be clear.
Yeah, just talking to me about it. And then he basically went into some very powerful dynamics about what he was feeling about his death. And it was along the lines of course, I would die in during duty. How else would I die? And he said, and I get emotional when I think about this. It was the profound statement of, my family is going to change something. So that dynamic resulted in what? Was it 5 years? I can't remember the details right in front of me. I don't have the story right in front of me. Right. What happened was the March family basically decided to take measures into their own hands and work to change the extradition laws from California or the United States to Mexico. That dynamic actually happened because of the passion of the loss of David. And that's the transformation that happens in these terrible, terrible, tragic situations of murder. We don't know what can be done from the other side. We don't know. I believe that it's still an information system where everybody's working together because, and this is what my next book is about. It's because of the love. It's because of the love that is so powerful. And when we lose somebody, whether it's a tragic situation or even, you know, COVID, we've all gone through the dynamic of COVID. What is it teaching us?
Wow, that's just so powerful. Wow, I'm speechless on that one only because of my own personal tragedy as a child, losing a brother. And it's given me such purpose after, and you know, people say there's purpose in the pain. I want to say there's purpose after the pain. That's where the transformation comes in too, because it's after you realize the pain is there. How do you get through that?
Well, that's right. That's exactly what it is. I mean, the three murders that I was a part of, because I knew these people, that happened within that 2 to 3 year period when I was 11, 12, and 13, that changed everything for me. I mean, it's a small town. How did I know those three people that died? What did it do to me? Well, it changed my whole dynamic about looking at murder, looking at death. That was before dead people started talking to me. This is, Juliet, why you are in front of this microphone talking to me today, March 28th, 2024. This is what we're doing. You're passionate about the love.
Right. And, you know, a lot of people don't put love in the courtroom. This is one of the things that I'm also, you know, yesterday, again, working with a client, you know, I know that sometimes they look at me like I'm a little nutty, but that's okay. I've been looked like that my whole life. But that said, what I say to them is so raw and honest that, like yesterday, I said, this is not just a case about facts, and I can't obviously talk about the case, but I want the heart to be in this case. I want the heart. Where's the heart in this case? And that's what I feel like my, you know, when you look at something, do you see that that's what your purpose is to bring heart into it, to bring, like you said, love, you know, is that how you feel like your position is sitting in your purpose in your career?
Well, I think it's because I didn't have a lot of dead people when I was growing up that I was connected to. Nobody was around me. Nobody died that I was related to. Animals, yes, but I never saw my grandparents. I didn't know any of them. And then my parents were older when they had me. And then when I lost my favorite aunt, I was not living in the area. When I lost my favorite uncle, I was not in the area. They lived in different states. I wasn't going to be part of that dynamic. My own personal deprivation in family dynamics I think, set me up to be able to do this in a way where I just have complete compassion. Overwhelmed by all the loss that happens in people's lives. So I help people, heal in those dynamics and learn that consciousness continues to survive death. Hey, listen, I was a skeptic, sort of snarky skeptic about this until it happened to me. And I was like, oh my God, I can't believe this. And then I started doing the research about it. And it basically is something that I don't care whether you're a skeptic. It's fine. Be a skeptic. I don't care. If I'm working for you, I'm going to bring information in for you that you can still throw away. I don't care about that either. I'm just doing my job.
Right. And that's interesting. You see it, like that as a job. And it's you. It's part of your DNA, right? I mean, in that sense that obviously it was there for a reason. So, one of my last few questions here for you is that why do you think that this work is so important, at least in my belief, yet it's so secret? Like I will bet you 9 out of 10 of my listeners will be like, what? There's what behind the scenes? Like, they don't even know I exist behind the scenes. But this, why do you think it's so secretive? Because people are so skeptical about it, or?
Well, it is kind of weird in the sense that it's not really looked at. Although I've been working with the science of this for the last 15 years with physicist, author, and consciousness expert Tom Campbell. And he was the guy that was doing NASA defense stuff. And he was also one of the people at the Monroe Institute, which is the largest educational school for expanded states of awareness, where the U.S. military were actually going to do brain entrainment. That's another thing, which is basically putting beats in either ear to help the stasis of the brain, just hold it there so you can easily access information that doesn't feel like it's physical. It's kind of like being a radio tower, Juliet, and you are one of these too, where you have a beacon and you are built for this, and you're all of a sudden you're getting non-physical matter reality coming into your brain, which is thoughts and feelings, and you have to translate it somehow. It comes out of your mouth, you write it down, and it becomes physical matter reality. So everybody's doing this. They just don't want to admit it. And, there's so many intuitive coaches out there. Well, they're just psychic. They just don't want to admit it. Even the military remote viewers, some of them would not call themselves psychic. But it's all psychic functioning because consciousness is fundamental.
And is it because psychic information is not tangible that we're afraid of it? Is it because, let me see if I can really formulate this question, because I've always found this so fascinating. We know it's true. How many times we've seen people now on TV and we've got, celebrities that are coming out on TV and we're seeing it's true. Why are we so skeptical about it if we know that it's there?
Well, part of it is, let's go back to the Bible. Which is basically, I know, that's a whole nother show. But it's information about, visions, prophecy, all of these. One of my favorite films to sort of talk about this time of year is the Joaquin Phoenix and Rumi Mara, Mary Magdalene. It's a great movie just to see the essence of a woman who didn't want to be controlled by her patriarchal family, who was being led and given information and pulled to people. Look, love pulls you together to be in partnership with someone. Love pulls you together from across the room with some sort of frequency or chemistry. When you're really sexy and you have chemistry with someone, hey, why don't you explain that? Right. Let's talk about the science of love, We just accept it. So there's so much awareness of consciousness now, understanding that people are just afraid of what someone will know. And of course, organized religion has been helpful to some and very harmful to others. This is the way I see it, and I'm going to cut off your head. Or this is the way I see it, and you're going to come to me on Sundays and we're going to have a really nice talk. Or you and me, well, this is kind of the way I see it. And this is kind of the way I'm feeling it. So take it and do something with it.
Right, 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 right. That's really beautifully put.
Awesome. Of I'm the only one that can do this, whether I'm a priest or a minister, people that talk like that, or those of us who go, you know what? We have a gift here and we're going to use it for the good.
Yeah. For the good. For the good. I think that might just have become the title. For the good. So, you know, I like to 2024, I used to ask about healing, but this year I'm asking about, if you could describe in one word your journey, what would it be?
Sorry, I just got really emotional about it. What a gift.
What a gift. That's fantastic. That is absolutely fantastic. Yeah. I do feel lucky sometimes too, don't you?
Well, you're going to be my student. That's all
okay. There is. I'm actually super thrilled and excited about that. So we were being, very excited about that. So where, Marla, where can people find you?
Well, the book, American Psychic, is on Audible. It's on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. Simon Schuster might still have it. You know, it's been out for 5 years, so who knows? But it's Marla Frees, F-R-E-E-S, M-A-R-L-A, F-R-E-E-S.com. And that's my website. And my book website is AmericanPsychicBook.com.
Well, it's a great read. It's a great read, people. I need you to get out and check it out, because it's also her personal story of her journey, and just a very inspiring book. It's been a few years since I read it too, but I passed it along to a few people. So, Marla, what a fantastic conversation. Boy, if we can find other stuff to talk about, you know, that can relate back to the law and anything you're working on would be fantastic. But I really want to thank you for, you got me kind of spurred up today. So I guess I'm thanking you for being here, but I'm not sure what's on our future. So we'll have to see what's going up with that.
Well, thank you. It's been a delight, and I can't wait to talk to you privately.
Okay. Well, thanks everyone for listening. And you know, what happens to you when you just sit in the quiet, sit in the bathtub and turn off everything, just listen? Who's talking to you? What's talking to you? A little bird that might be showing up that represents a family member, or in my world, it's dimes from my grandfather that show up every so often, just speaking to me in different ways. And so I'm just asking you today to kind of just give some thought to that. You know, who's speaking to you to help you have a bigger purpose in this physical human suit? And how are you bringing in the love that we've had this conversation about today? So thanks again for joining me. And remember, go out and spread the love. Have a great day.
Thanks for listening to Trauma, Trial, and Transformation. If you want to share your experience as a witness, please forward your information to info@juliethuck.com. For more information on Juliet's 30-year career in the courtroom, visit us at juliethuck.com. There you can find her books, The Equation of Persuasion and 50 Ways to Get Your Way, available on Amazon. Remember to follow and subscribe to Trauma, Trial, and Transformation wherever you listen to podcasts. The content, opinions, and information shared by the hosts and guests on this podcast are not to be considered professional legal advice or therapeutic counseling. If you need assistance, consult with a licensed attorney or therapist if you are appearing as a witness, experiencing emotional trauma, or are involved in any sensitive legal matters. The views expressed by guests are their own, and their appearance on the program does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. Thank you.